session. Good morning, everyone. We're going to be having a presentation on the economic opportunities of renewable development. And my understanding is, having talked to Mr. Laird before we convene, that he's going to be focusing in on some very specific recruitment efforts in clean technology, and has said to me that this is the most exciting opportunity that he's had in his career. So we're very fortunate to have him here today. Welcome and good morning.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I'll try to tee this up. For the record, I'm Bob Repine, Director of Economic and Community Development. If you remember our discussion from last Friday, we were talking about some of the activities that the agency has been involved in with the National Governors Association on the academy work on trying to make, how do we help make Oregon much more of a standout? So when it comes to recruiting or expanding or retaining companies here, that we show them we have some really specialized industry opportunities. With that same theme or thought, we have over the last 6 to 8 months been working on a very strategic approach to do business expansion opportunities. And I want to make sure, as I said last Friday, I want to make sure when I say business expansion, that includes everything from existing Oregon businesses to allow them to expand either into the field they already are or maybe expand into other business opportunities. And it includes potentially recruitment, too, so expansion for other companies wanting to do business in Oregon. We think at the end of the day, whether it comes from expansion or recruitment, it's good for Oregon, particularly if there is a common industry opportunity or a cluster. And we talked about that Friday also, cluster industries. How do you grow these organic industry opportunities in your communities and really build some other industry components around that so the likelihood and the opportunity of success improves dramatically? With the work from, I want to give credit where credit's due, Tim McCabe in the governor's office, he's the economic advisor to the governor, and Mr. Laird, working on a strategy. And how do you start figuring out, very strategically, start to help enhance or grow an industry? Probably in the past, industry recruitment was more of who came a-knocking at our door, and we would go out and see how they would fit in our industry. Or if it was expansion, much the same. So today, what this model that Bruce and Mr. McCabe have been working on, it really looks at the industry as a whole. And it identifies or has identified industries that we have here in Oregon today that add to this clean tech agenda from one end of the spectrum to the other, from product design to product sales. And then it helps to figure out what we are lacking in that chain of events. And so the idea is, how do you start filling in the right partners at the right places so when you step back after it's all done, you have everything from production to sales on the other side. And so it's a continuum all the way through. With that, you get the synergy of a cluster. You have reliance that you have every piece in place. You have reliance that you have a workforce that is actually a very transitional workforce from their work to potentially other work that is part of the product production. And so it actually builds a very strong premise or base for sustainable business opportunities in Oregon. So we've chosen the clean tech because, as you heard from our NGA presentation last week, we believe Oregon is well positioned to work in the sustainable world. And clean tech is a piece of that sustainability, obviously. Bruce will talk more in the details of it. So what we've started on is a transition of what economic opportunities for Oregon means. So while we are trying to be mindful of how we've always done business activities in the state of Oregon, because that's important, we want to make sure we don't lose any ground. We can't just shut the state of our system off saying, well, for the next 6 months we're retooling and we'll get back to you, because every day a new company from Oregon is wanting to expand. Every day a new company from Oregon wants to possibly relocate. We're trying to convince them not to relocate, or there's a company who wants to come to Oregon. So while we're balancing those current activities, we're also trying to work on some other very specific recruiting techniques that really will become extremely beneficial, I believe, in the years to come. And I think, as Bruce mentioned to you, Mr. Chair, and you stated on the record, Bruce believes, and I would concur, that this is probably some of the most exciting recruitment activities that we've ever been involved in the state of Oregon. I think I mentioned that Friday. I think we're on the change of a whole new genre of economic opportunities, much different than we've ever done in the past, but more exciting as we go into the future. So I think this presentation will show you where we're going and what we hope to achieve. We'd also, Mr. Chairman and committee members, encourage you, this is more of a dialogue presentation. So if you see a slide and you have some questions or you want to probe with that, Mr. Laird, I would say, is pretty close to being a certified smart expert in this stuff. And then let me just give you just a quick brief on the agency as a whole. Historically, a year ago, let's say, we had 12 business development officers, and each of you have a business development officer somewhere in your region. I have 12 of them out, pretty much outposted in the state of Oregon. We took Bruce and a lady by the name of Jill Miles, who's located up in the northeast portion of the state. So Bruce is up in, down in Medford, and Jill is up in the La Grande area. And they are kind of our key industry recruiting people. So what we did was let the remaining 10 people be the soldiers on the ground in your regions, really working at the cold calls, knocking on doors, asking business A whether or not they have some business opportunities that they want to explore on expansion or extension of their services. We'll get those same people will be involved with leads that come in from the regional partners that have economic activities going on, such as down in Bruce's area, SoReady, up in here in Marion County, it's SEDCOR. Central Oregon has an economic strategy, Northeast Corner. There's a series of these regional partners that are empowered to work on regional economic activities at the local level, and then my business development officer works with them. What Bruce and Jill do is really become very strategic experts on a variety of industry opportunities and become very, they get assigned to these companies to work very hands-on with them. So while they still are business development officers in the truest sense that they are working in the local level, they get called in to work on very strategic business recruitment activities. And then, so it actually adds a higher level of expertise and a point person for the agency. So it's been actually very well received by our partners. I think we've probably got some of the best reviews from our site selectors who come to Oregon who are looking for business opportunities. They know they only have to work with 2 people instead of 12 people, so it helps, I think, a great deal. Then you get a sense of confidence. Anytime you work on a continued basis with somebody, your confidence grows with that work with that individual. So I think that also has helped considerably on some of the activities that are now spearheading some of the clean tech work that Bruce is doing. So just a little background of what we've changed up in the last year since you were in the building.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Mr. Laird. Thank you for turning out so early on the morning when much of the rest of the world is enjoying a holiday today. So certainly appreciate your coming to share what's happening in clean tech with us.
You're up, Emma. Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm really honored to be here. I hope my unchecked enthusiasm doesn't, I don't get over the top on this subject. It's really a historic opportunity as we transition out of the oil into new energy futures. And one of the things I'm going to format my presentation around is I'm really going to be talking about our marketing plan and looking at the technologies. Well, I'm going to start off. I think Bob already took the first part, so I'll go through it quickly. We'll take a look at the division, how we're organized, what our job duties are. Try to keep that in mind because we really are building our plan around that, the mission. We'll review the clean tech targets, look at their growth rate, look at our prospects in there. We'll go over these targets with specific discussions by technology category, talk about the number of accounts, the strengths and weaknesses and challenges that we've got going, and then go to a marketing plan summary, very kind of an overview of what's up in the future. Scattered through there's some of the challenges and barriers that we're encountering as we move into an all-new environment. And that's one of the things that we're learning. This is a real learning experience as we become progressively more educated in what's known as the clean technology area. One of the things about the energy future is it looks like a diverse portfolio. There is no silver bullet out there, one fix as we move off of the carbon-based energy sources. And one of the challenges for government, local, state, or otherwise, is that we are looking at a change agenda that's going to go all the way through our system. And we've already had some meetings as we've been talking about how does this affect state government, how does this affect how agencies work together, how it works with our community partners. So it's a journey. We're at the beginning. And it's real interesting stuff. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. I'm Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I'm specifically housed inside the Business and Trade Development Division. Our mission is to advance Oregon's economy, and that's pretty key because one of our objectives in our clean tech plan is that all of Oregon participates. This doesn't work if everybody doesn't come to the table. Our first core foundation is we work to retain existing businesses and to expand existing businesses. That's where everything starts. Then we move on quality jobs, and I'll move through this very quickly, and then we move to business recruitment. There's the Bob's map. 12 business development officers, and we're regionally located. You can see the territory. We have ten of the staff are really focused on more retention, expansion, and regional development issues, where two of us are recruitment specialists that we're still housed regionally and keep that contact out with the more far-flung parts of the state. And then as far as our duty assignments, this breaks it down so you can see what staff is doing with their time. And I think you should notice that about 55% of all of our time that's in business development, job creation side, falls down in the retention and expansion category. Now, if you add the business recruitment specialists in there, the breakout is something like 84% is focused on retention expansion. I know that number doesn't make any sense, but the point of it is, and what we're talking about is that recruitment gets all of the media coverage, but it's by far the minority of our task assignments and where we spend our time. The other thing that's significant is we focus on traded sector accounts. Traded sector are companies that produce goods and services which are sold outside the state of Oregon. We don't do retail. Clean tech cluster targets. And I've got a chart coming up that shows the growth rate. You might have spotted in there. But wind, which is manufacturing and generation, solar, and these are, by the way, listed in their growth, percentage of growth in the marketplace over a 10-year period. Solar, biofuels, and geothermal. Now, these are the four primary categories. These are the big four. And then in a smaller, more emerging category, we're looking at wave and the electric vehicles and systems surrounding it. But those are, I'd like to say, those are emerging. They're there, and we want to pay attention to them because we think they're significant technologies. First things first. Okay. Oh, here we go. All of Oregon. That, again, I keep emphasizing that because it's a significant thing. We were just looking at an announcement of a $900-megawatt wind project out there in Gilliam County area, and $1.2 billion. Now, those turbines are probably manufactured, and we'll talk about that in a bit. Certainly, primarily not in Oregon, but the tax revenues and the jobs for installation and maintenance are all Oregon jobs. And this is starting to become a very significant employment cluster just in the maintenance, operation, training, and systems surrounding it. And that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah. Representative Huffman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to point out also, one of the big boons of this market for wind energy for the counties has been the revaluation of EFU. So it's been a boon in revenue to the counties because they can assess the wheat land instead of several square feet of EFU. They can actually assess it for a greater value. So that's been part of the great boon for out east.
I tried to dig those numbers up. I didn't have I ran out of time, but we think right now that property tax revenues off wind could be one of the largest, the single largest category for several of Oregon counties out in that area right now.
And for the benefit of anyone who may be listening in, to our hearings today through our audiovisual technology, EFU stands for
Exclusive Farm Use.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you
for the audience and our chair.
And the chair. And the chair. And the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I also understand, Representative Huffman, from our hearing the other day, that we've actually in your district developed a new course area of study. Is there a degree involved?
Yes, there is. I believe it has moved in the second wave to a two-year certification. The original course was a one-year certification, and I call it wind whispering, but it's a windsmith course at Columbia Gorge Community College, and Dr. Frank Toda has been extremely involved in developing this with the manufacturers worldwide. I think he's dealing with four wind companies in developing this course, and they have actually contributed financially to the course. They can turn out about 35 students per course, and the backlog of need is overwhelming. It's hundreds that they need. And so it's one of those things. Dr. Toda says, give me more money to hire more instructors and have more classroom space, and we'll turn out more windsmiths.
Mr. Chairman, if you're of interest to you and the committee, there's actually a well-prepared DVD on this. It's been used as a marketing tool, quite frankly, to show individuals that this is an emerging technology. And it's kind of like a recruitment, I think it's 17 to 20 minutes, but it might be very interesting for you to see this. It's very, very well done, and it really tells the story and really shows how this is. But it's very important to put your resource opportunities through your job training opportunities into industries that are emerging like this. So I have a copy of it. If you'd like to have a copy of that to review sometime, I'd be more than happy to show it.
I'd love to see it. Frankly, if we had time to show it, I think it might be worthwhile as part of our informational proceedings here for this committee, because I think it would also show the public just, you know, what is involved with an emerging technology and how it tends to spin off, in this instance, jobs, a new curriculum at a community college, additional secondary and tertiary jobs and sectors. So I think all of that would be very interesting.
I'd be happy to work with your committee staff to have that available to you.
Thank you.
You know, Mr. Chair, this is a neat example of one of those jobs that 5 years ago wasn't even on the radar screen. It didn't exist almost, and it's been very well accepted by and large out in my district, with the exception of one controversial proposed site right now that's adjacent to the scenic area. But other than that, it's been very, very well received.
Well, it is. Mr. Laird's already said this is very, very exciting, and the fact that we are on the cutting edge of developing an entirely, not only a new industry, but clusters in that industry, I think is just exciting and a wonderful economic and workforce development opportunity that we ought to be able to share with the public. So,
Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Laird is excited about the industry, what I've and I think I expressed this last Friday when we were here as a panel of people from other agencies, what I see is this tremendous opportunity. Well, you know, we always talk about collaboration in government as much as possible. We still always end up in our little silos as days go on. This really has become, I think, a real opportunity for neutralizing silo walls. And as you saw, I had Cam Price here from community colleges and Lori Warner from the Employment Division. This would not come about if with the president of the campus at the community college in that area, along with Camille's interest in trying to make sure that they know what we're working on. I mean, the irony of all this is we're out there recruiting businesses that may not even be identified as training opportunities yet. And they should be right in our shirt pocket with us, so when we're talking with these companies, they can go, oh, you know, if that company is going to be here in the next 10 or 20 months, we need to be thinking about how we can start filling in that work stream, because that's a niche for us. And we can become, you know, we can get ahead of this, as opposed to have an industry show up and saying, well, where's the workers that you're going to have here for us? So it really is exciting opportunities to have diverse agencies that have, you know, their own thing to do on a day-to-day basis to come together on these type of economic activities. And that's why I think I told you Friday, everybody owns a piece of economic development in the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. It's the colleges, it's K through 12, it's everybody, because we can go out and do the, Bruce can go out and do the recruitments and, or all go to companies that want to expand, but if we can't turn around to see who our natural partners are that help align those components of success through workers or whatever it might be, then we really don't have a lot to sell. So, you know, it's really exciting from that perspective.
Well, and it's not only exciting, I think, from the direct industry development, but also the secondary industries that it may spin off. Bruce just mentioned I think it was 900. Was it 900 megs of
900 megawatts
Of generating capacity? That's a tremendous development in and of itself. But his comment that most of these turbines are not being manufactured here in Oregon, I think, is suggestive of another tremendous opportunity at hand.
That's right.
So.
Right.
So, anyways, excuse me.
Oh, no, this is, you know, I've, part of our, I'll get this presentation clearly, it's going to go everywhere. But part of what we're doing is engaging our communities, and that this is the reaction we're getting, is that everybody throughout Oregon sees this opportunity. It's real exciting. I've got to add on the workforce thing. Workforce development is one of our identified strategies around the wind. We recognize that as one of the keys. And the pioneer work that's being done up in the gorge is fantastic stuff. We've really got a chance for leadership around that. So anyway.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you. Please educate me and maybe us. When we're talking about the 900 megawatts compared to the Bonneville Dam, what's the percentage of it?
Well, Vice Chair Lim, I know that Trojan Nuclear Power Plant, which was dismantled and decommissioned in my area, mm-hmm. was on the order of 1,200 megs. So we're getting very close here to the equivalent generating capacity of a nuclear power plant. So it's very significant.
The Trojan nuclear power considered about 6%.
Yes.
Of the total usage of electricity, if I remember this is correct. So now I know approximately. Mm-hmm. And where this the windmills made? Is it made in the United States or out of the countries?
Why don't we just let go of the schedule and we go to it. This is one of the windmill systems, which is out in eastern Oregon. As you can see, the windmill, the 10-year annual compounded growth rate is 29%, which is just a phenomena. The only reason it's not any higher than that is if there's critical bottlenecks in the supply chain, they are simply not able to bring on certain specific components fast enough. And there's two primary component problems in this scale of generator. Now, this is not a monolithic industry. The central utility scale turbines are all up there, and they used to be 1.5, then you get greater efficiencies as you move up in scale. So these are probably somewhere in the 2 range. The new ones that are coming on Vestas are 3.5 megawatt units, and there's 5 megawatt units out there on the horizon. Now, Oregon right now has 1,000 megawatts of installed capacity out there. Now, we think, and I beg your indulgences on this because these are real estimates, but we think under the renewable energy standards, where we're targeting 25% of our energy by year 2025, is that we need to get somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,800 average megawatts. So if you talk 900 megawatts in a new windmill, you start scaling the perspective of this. Now, the question is, where are the turbines built? Okay, these large central utility-scale turbines are a true global product. They're very similar to an automobile, which is asking, where is that car built? Well, the answer is everywhere. The blades, which are one of the significant components, are built either in northern Europe, which would be somewhere between Denmark and Germany, but more so than ever, they're being built in China and Vietnam because they're extremely labor-intensive items to produce, and they're built under licensed intellectual rights by either Vestas or Siemens or GE or those folks. Bearings are produced either in Japan, Korea, United States, and Northern Europe. Windings, and then you get into the other nacelles, components, the electronics. They're real global products. Now, one of the things that we're doing is we look at this, and bear with me a little bit. Hopefully this all works. Is that we're looking at what is our manufacturing capacities inside the state of Oregon. So we're going through two different systems to generate databases of who has capacities based on the NAIC codes of the components. We actually took turbines, broke them out into components, looked at the NAIC codes, and said who in Oregon is working in these category areas. So we're in the process of developing databases so that we can go out to the people we're talking to. And instead of trying to get the entire turbine, we're not out there saying, hey, build your turbines. We're saying, here's our database of people who can supply you critical components to help you time to market. So we're working on connecting Oregon companies to turbine manufacturers. Now, that's just one example of what we're trying to do in this space. But it gives you an idea of one approach that we're pursuing. Now, where was I? The other thing, talking about where these produce, are really a global product. They come together for final assembly. So then we're saying, well, gosh, don't you think we should do system integration work? And there's a logistics side in here. So let's take a look at that logistic movement, because those blades, everybody's probably seen them, those things are huge. They are absolutely, I mean, they're just amazing. They're so big, and they need to be tuned and worked and whatnot. So we know that we have a respectable wind resource, but the real wind resource, by the way, is up there, Texas, moving up through the Dakotas and whatnot. That's the mother load out there, and that's where all the action is going to head pretty quick. So we want a position as that comes online, and we think, and I've got another slide that gives you an idea of the growth rate that's out there. We want to position both our manufacturing capacity and our logistic capacity to catch this global product and transition. Now, we've got another problem that you're dealing with in these things, is that just the nacelle portion, which is that top thing where the blade connects, those things are weighing up somewhere between 30, 40, and 50 tons. So you've got a real problem moving those things around. So you can't move them on the highways. You're either going to move them by barge or by rail, which means you're probably looking at final system integration somewhere closer to the facility. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an idea of some of our actions surrounding wind, but that's not the only thing that we're doing in the wind category. boy, this discussion, I think, is really going to...
Mr. Chairman, if I might add, while Bruce is going back to where he was at, I think, what causes all of us to get excited, and I think I saw it in some of the reactions of your faces, while we talk about the wind turbine industry as an industry that might be so far away from us to entice them to want to manufacture those units here or assemble them here, we have a huge opportunity to match up industries in Oregon today with these people who are desperately trying to find other vendors or suppliers that can supply the backlog of the components that they need made. And we have, as you saw on the list, some of the most sophisticated manufacturing companies in the world here in Oregon. And so why not try to use that as, just if nothing else, as another way to create economic opportunities? So always there is the big unit. You sit there and look at it and say, well, that'll never get built here, and you can just say, okay, that's the end of our discussion. But while we still are pursuing those activities, we're also working on the other side of the small pieces, the subcomponents of what makes up or constitutes one of those assemblies at the end of the day. So, again, attacking a problem for economic reasons from both ends, quite different than we've historically done, but very exciting because, as you can see, the potential job opportunities from, let's say, becoming the supplier of bearings for these things. I mean, it could mean hundreds of jobs to a company in Oregon for many, many, many years to go as this industry keeps on rolling up.
Excellent. But wait, there's more. I'm sorry. Your clean tech definition is superior performance at lower cost and greatly reduced or eliminate negative ecological impacts. And primarily what we're talking about there are gaseous emissions in the criteria there of your greenhouse gases. Here's your growth rates, and this is really the numbers that we are paying a lot of attention to. We're changing and learning as we go into this, and that's the big thing. We were kidding around that our development marketing plan seems to change every month because this is such a fast developing and changing space to be working in. Wind is, as you can see, 29%, and that's a 10-year compounded growth. If they didn't have such bottlenecks in their supply chain, I'll bet you that number would be 50%. It is just amazing. And it's all about price. Wind is a commodity energy now. It's four or five cents range at the bus bar. That's where you connect the turbine to the electrical cord. Solar, somewhere around a 26% growth rate. Solar is felt to be, as far as overall grand scale solutions, to be one of the big ones. It also has significant constraints in the supply chain. Biofuels, that number, we're not sure that number's correct. And there's an area that's waiting for a technology breakthrough, and there's one on the horizon that's quite promising. Geothermal, which we want to talk about because that's another one. Boy, Oregon can really do well in. This is only like a 3%, but interestingly enough, inside geothermal, you get your ground heat pumps, which are actually based inside the ground. That has a 10 to 11% annual growth rate inside that. Wow. And so there's another area that we think we can break apart and look at manufacturing components and go after. So just enormous economic opportunity surrounding this whole area of your clean tech technologies and energy generation. And we haven't even touched the other side of the equation, which is conservation sustainability, which is also dynamic.
Before Bruce didn't talk about WAVE, I want to make sure it doesn't go not mentioned. WAVE was the last one on there. Again, relatively emerging industry, very isolated areas where that's being examined or tested. So it really hasn't come up to grid or anything that would show any kind of growth in this industry today. But as you know, the state has made some strong investments in WAVE research and WAVE opportunities here in the Oregon area because we are deemed to be one of the more highly sought after potentials for WAVE actuaries where the movement of the water will create some energy opportunities for the state or the United States, maybe if it ever was to roll up more. So it doesn't show anything on there, but it's obviously an industry we're tracking very closely because we want to make sure we keep that industry moving along.
Where the I would arguably tell you that where wave is today would be where wind was 20 years ago, when you first started hearing about wind. But the interesting part, where it's taken 20 years to get wind where it is today as technology goes, wave will move much quicker because they'll learn from the experiences mm-hmm. from the wind industry. So mm-hmm. it's an industry that will move much more quickly than we saw in any of the other alternative energies.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me a visualization of wave energy? I've read enough just to be dangerous. it's easy to picture a Bonneville Dam along the coastline or something.
Right there.
But in reality,
that's it.
Okay.
Well, that's one form. That's the one that lays on the surface, if I'm not mistaken. It undulates. It lays on top and snakes like a serpent, and so within that action creates the dynamics that generates the power. So that's one version that you see more up in the European coastal.
Thank you, because I've never seen a visualization. So
well, this unit is the first one to go commercial, and it's off the Portugal. They have I think it's like a 5 megawatt, maybe it's larger, off of Portugal. This is the first one that's gone commercial. That unit you're looking at is somewhere around a megawatt of production power. And the challenge with this one, it's an early stage technology, and it's right now it's about 30 cents kilowatt hour. Now, wind, as Bob mentioned, came down fourfold in about 15 years. So we take a fourfold reduction in this, and let's say they can accelerate in 10 years. We have grid competitive power in 10 years with this technology. Now, one of the reasons we really want to pay attention to this is, let me show you the next one here. That's what a factory floor looks like.
It's scale. Give the idea of size.
There isn't anything if you can build a boat, you can build a sawmill, you can build this thing.
Amazing. Representative Huffman, if you ever get the chance, I would highly recommend that you go down to Oregon State University and tour their wave generation facility there.
Point absorber.
It is absolutely amazing, and that facility is one of the leaders worldwide in terms of development of wave energy. So a tremendous opportunity. Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. A couple of things. Just a quick comment on this. We've got a lot of factories around Oregon that can build this kind of device.
Absolutely.
Two questions. First one, the issue here is not theory, it's engineering, isn't it?
Yes.
And that was true with the wind power as well, as I understand it. I mean, mm-hmm. we know how to generate electricity. We know how to use linear generator mm-hmm. or something similar to that mm-hmm. that these devices use. Second question, what is the cost of traditional methods of generating electricity that might be installed using fossil fuels? I'm thinking of generation cost. I'm thinking of gas turbines or other things like that, mm-hmm. not hydroelectric. But, I mean, because that's the comparison we're talking about on one level.
coal prices, and it depends how you view the coal price, with no carbon accounting at all, coal is probably, at the bus bar, 3.5 cents, okay. 4 cents, somewhere in those numbers. And please forgive the inexactitude. Natural gas as a modern combined cycle peaker plant is highly volatile in price. It's raw material dependent, not capital,
right.
And it depends when you price it out, but some would suggest that natural gas 7 or 8 cents, somewhere in those numbers.
Okay.
And that's not accounting for transmission. Transmission's probably another penny kilowatt hour. This really is, now this is only one of the technologies. This is so new. There's so much innovation going on here that, now this in the trade, this is referred to as lunar energy because tides affect the moon. Okay. With your forgiveness, and I apologize, but I got to show you this. In the lunar energy category, here's one that we've looked at, which we think is going to be most problematical, and this is deep ocean currents. And those are very large scale, and they put them down at the bottom of the ocean where you have, say, deep tidal current movements, and they're using these in the UK and whatnot. But we think this is an emerging technology that's ecologically troublesome. Anyway, it's not a joke.
Well, if I may, my understanding too is that there are only a few places in the world where this is even possible because of the locations of the tidal movements.
Mm-hmm.
Oregon, of course, is the place where you can do wave.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, getting back to Representative Huffman's question also, on the type of component that lies on top of the ocean, there is the ones that are referred more commonly as the buoy type. That's the ones that we've been doing the research in the off the Oregon coast on with a couple companies and the universities. They're basically a little different in the fact that they tether down in the water. So they get they have to be connected to this the ocean floor, which creates some economic issues or some environmental issues because of the lines. They basically stand upright as opposed to lying horizontally, and they move up and down with the current. So it moves up and down with the wave surge or wind water surge. So a different technology. What I think the key piece is, as they're researching with these devices, much like what the wind went through, the earlier wind versions, as you heard Bruce talk about how many kilowatts they created, in the older versions, it might have been 1 to 1.5 kilowatts. So now they're doing up to 3.5, maybe go to 4, you know, only assumably in a very short period of time they could be 5. So if you can get more energy off of one of those wind turbines, that helps because you're not having to proliferate the landscape with all these wind turbines. Same thing goes with the wave modules. They are low producers of energy right now. And as the technology improves, they can get more electrical product from that action than the concern or the fear of how big these farms have to be under the water diminishes, because otherwise you could have literally, you know, effectively hundreds of these trying to make up enough energy to make it worthwhile for the investment. So the important part of this is, I think, as the technology moves ahead quicker and these type of alternative energy devices, hopefully we'll get a scale that they'll create much more energy per unit, so you don't have to have as many of them placed out in the ocean. Mm-hmm. That's the issue here, I think, more than anything else.
Vice Chairman.
Thank you. This might be a little bit different subject, but still in the same area. Concerning the biofuel the energy, it seems to me to produce biofuel costs quite high compared to the wind, solar, or any others. Even I got a letter from my constituents, is sometimes a tendency to break down the cars when they use biofuel. And can you expand a little bit on that issue? Because when I read in the newspaper concerning biofuel, it seems to me there's no big winner in this price of soybeans going up plus others. And then it seems to me self-defeating. I'm wondering, could you expand some of these issues?
Well, I brought up a slide that shows cellulosic ethanol production, and I can talk a bit about the technology and mention that there is a downside, of course, to ethanol, as you referenced. I don't know that this is an official position, but I it's where the money's at. Wall Street stopped putting any money into the food-based or the grain-based ethanols about 2 years ago. The money market really is not interested in that technology at all. Energy inputs to energy outputs under a best-case scenario are 3 to 4, 3 in, 4 out. It is not a sustainable technology. Now, cellulosic ethanol is a different duck altogether. And what's going on, and we're picking this up, and we'll go back to it when we talk about the money, because one of the reasons we're so enthusiastic about this is this is actually a secondary wood product.
Hmm.
And this again gets back to the issue of of government having to change and rethink how we approach our mission here. Because in this picture, there's a lot going on. That's a bioengineered crop that they've engineered the reduction of a Lenigan structure that's what gives it strength and whatnot. And that's what protects the cellulose. Hopefully I've got all this right. And the enzymes, they've gone around, people like Lawrence Berkeley Lab have gone around and harvested the enzymes out of termites. And you think about it, a termite eats wood, and what do they do with it? Is they digest it and turn it to a sugar. Well, they take the easier, this is like, I guess you would call it baby food for termites. You know, they made it easier to digest. And you put them into vats with the enzymes, and you get sugars that they then can ferment through to an ethanol. And they're getting very promising yields. This is where all the money's going. We just had an announcement of a cellulosic enzyme project up in the Port of Morro with Pacific Ethanol. And we knew these grants were out there. Huge credit to Pacific Ethanol and Oregon Department of Energy. This is really quite a coup. Everybody's on. The real folks have moved on this about a year ago. Mid 2007, Weyerhaeuser and Chevron signed a biofuel alliance using each of their strengths. Chevron, of course, is headquartered down in California, which is the epicenter of some of these technologies. And Chevron's looking at Weyerhaeuser's skill sets, moving fiber and transporting and harvesting and controlling, and Chevron brings the technology and the enzymes and then in the channel for the distribution of the final end product, the ethanol. So we think this is a secondary wood play as well as an egg play as we look at straw and other waste materials, or not waste, these are value products. The challenge that we think is out there is this is a highly disruptive technology, because now your hog fuel, which fire the boilers and the straw that goes into hay cubes, all are now competing in a transportation fuel market, which we believe has a higher value and changes the entire economic underpinnings of these value products out in our system. I hope that was a little long, but...
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Bruce, this is the technology that you were referencing in your introduction that was pending here.
Just one of them. Yeah. Just one of them. There are so many technology breakthroughs that are being sought to make these renewable works, and that's one of the challenges for us, is that we're trying to focus on winners rather than almost has-beens.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Just the picture over there, is that the picture of our state or some other places, just showing us an example?
This picture right here?
Yeah.
No, that's not. And I can't tell you where that picture is taken. But the crop there is Macanthus floridus, also Japanese silver grass. And they get dramatic yields off it. The Canadian government has invested in hemp as a cellulose because it grows better in northern climes.
Okay.
And they're getting just fantastic tonnage per acre off this stuff. The other crop that works well is your bioengineered poplars and eucalyptuses.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, as these reach in, next slide up, I think one of the things that's worth noting to all of you, and you probably realize this, but I thought I'd at least say it on the record, the industries that we're working in today, and particularly in this clean tech environment, are moving at such a light speed of technology changes. We don't have that opportunity where in the old days, industry would find a system, they would work it for a while, technology would take a much longer time to make the next iteration of it, or next generation of it. Today, it's almost like what you see in the marketplace on consumer products. The technology that you're finding on your cell phone today is being quickly replaced by a cell phone that's going to be out in the market 3 months from now. Mm-hmm. And so we're having to move at this lightning speed rate just to keep up with, where do you put your bet? Where do you make your investments so you're not investing in technology that is going to be so far outdated in such a short period of time that it was a bad place to be invested in. So while biofuels, we have some biofuels facilities, utilities, we're very mindful of the constraints or concerns of that industry today, making sure that the ones we're working with have an outgame plan. So many of these can be converted into, say, cellulosity facilities with some minor technical changes. You don't want to invest in any old industry technology that can't be converted, because it'll just sit there. It'll be something that's going to be scrapped down and torn down.
Old as any year old?
Well, that's effectively representative. That's how fast it's moving. It's pretty amazing. I think when Bruce checks into me at the office, he said, this is an industry that is just on, running at a quarter mile speed, not long distance running. Yeah, this is fast.
Yeah, yeah. Representative Barnhart.
Two questions. This is, I'm not sure exactly what the technical word is, but this is the modern cool manufacturing systems rather than the hot, old-fashioned hot ones, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
We're using bugs to do the work rather, or enzymes rather,
yes,
than brute force chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Exactly so, and thereby we're reducing the energy inputs to recover the fuel.
Right.
So you're using a chemical process. Yeah.
Thank you. And the second question I had, my recollection is when we passed the biofuels bill last year, we included provisions for cellulosic.
Yes.
I'm assuming that we're going to have to revisit that bill to make certain that we've got it in the right shape probably next year, based on the comment that I just heard about the speed with which things are moving.
Probably a good chance. If nothing else, an opportunity to have that discussion to make sure it is, as you look at it, we need to review it, because what we're reviewing for, what is it going to look like 2 years hence? So
right.
The question is, we may not be there today, in the next following 2 years, would the potential of the industry be in a position to take advantage of those credits, and now the credits don't align, or the economic opportunities you're giving them are not going to align with their end products? And so, we need to have those discussions.
And then a final,
please.
This may be a comment rather than a question. If you want to try to answer it, please do. Right now, we're trying to incent these kinds of activities with various tax credits and subsidies of various kinds. Based on the numbers you gave a few minutes ago about wind energy and some of these other things in terms of their actual cost, it looks to me as though there's a possibility that the time will come soon when the issue isn't going to be the cost, competition with traditional sources, but rather the availability of manufacturing systems to manufacture these devices. You may not have a thought about that today, but at some point it would be useful to hear what your thoughts are about that issue.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I think it's probably too soon, but I think the big wild card out there is federal carbon regulatory environment and how they approach those criteria gases. And if they go to the model that we looked at, I think it was the fluorocarbons, the ozone-depleting gases, that could have a dramatic effect. And wind is a commodity right now, and I think workforce training and certain other things, manufacturing capacities, could jump to a leadership position on that one, that particular area.
To the point that Representatives Riley and Barnhart have made about how fast this technology turns over, the ethanol manufacturing facility at Port Westward, which is due to come online this spring, is preparing right now, as they're still in the construction phase, to begin cellulosic production within 5 years.
Yes.
Amazing.
It really is amazing. I've got a slide in here that I put into it because it's the amazing thing, but we'll get to it in a minute. Here's our rule of thumb. This is nothing more than just to give you some scaling about what's going on. 1,000 megawatts of annual production, that is a factory that produces 1,000 megawatts of equipment a year, is going to cost about $2 billion, and there'll be around 2,000 manufacturing jobs there, and 1,000 jobs to make those systems work. So what we're doing with renewables is we're replacing hydrocarbons with jobs and technology, and that's one of the big things that's happening here. I've got some slides here that talk about money. Clean technology is where Wall Street's going. This is the big, there's even talks, is it a bubble? This is the new tech thing that's out there. And it's not abating at all, by the way. Not at all. The big boys are in the business now. You see Goldman Sachs, KKR, all those guys. And one of the things that we're doing for our marketing initiative is that we're like fishermen. We want to find out where all the fish are at. Well, we go to the money centers and find out where the money's going. And so we're one of our marketing efforts, and we work with Tim McCabe, is we go to the Cleantech Venture Network, and we hang out with the venture capitalists and find out what the smart play is in money. And that's been a good place to track all this. Energy generation is leading in the investment dollars. And West Coast leads in where the money's going. One of the primary, I think there's two or three reasons for this. One is that we have policy position. Policy does matter. The other thing is California is a hotbed of money. And the same venture network and money that funded everything is funding this. And the money has a tendency to stay a little closer to the money center. So I think that's part of it. The Northeast has been robust in this area. We did lose a project, I think it was last year. It was code name Apollo. It's Evergreen Solar, which is part of the Qcell systems out of Germany. And that was a project that we looked at their, we screened it, we looked at their statements and just couldn't get, we just couldn't get there. It didn't meet our screening test on a financial basis for us to reach into it. And that's another good example of our protocols is that we try to be careful. We do look at finances. We try to look at their technology, their channels. And sometimes, you know, they don't work out.
You commented on the importance of investment capital. Could you also comment on the importance of research facilities and, in particular, state-run university research centers?
Yes, actually, that is one of my key points I was going to talk about. Let me jump into it, is that we just lost... This is great. It is really fun. This is fun.
Guy likes his work.
Yes, I was thinking exactly the same.
Yeah, well, it really isn't. I mean, I'm you know, here to. This is known as a concentrated solar power systems, and this is the lowest cost power system that's out there right now. There's probably three main components in here, and we were really on fire to get one of the main producers of the tubes in the middle, and this thing's actually an optical thing. It focuses the light. You get like a 25 magnification. Heats up the oil, organic oil that's in those tubes, and then it goes into a heat exchanger. And the power cost on these is at or below a natural gas peaker plant. So this is right now. This is happening. In fact, there. Just a quick look at it. This was just inaugurated. They just opened up. They had their big event Friday. Mm-hmm. Friday. Okay. And so that's 64 megawatts, 200 acres. I'll come back to that.
100 acres. That was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
200 acres.
In a place where nothing grows.
Yeah.
Well, they're harvesting electrons.
Yeah.
Different harvesting.
Yeah, areas. Different harvesting. So the question is, beating around the bush a bit here, I apologize. The question is, what is the linkage to these technologies to education system? We just did our debrief on losing the SHOT account. And again, SHOT and another account who we're in close dialogue with produce these tubes in the middle. And those are really pretty trick technology. And they've been at it for quite some time. And one of the primary reasons that they selected the other site, well, they were lower cost, but that wasn't it, was that the other site had a 5,000-acre renewable energy park that was hooked into their university structure, and they had endowed chairs in the technology And the university was hooked to the Sandia Labs, and they also put a targeted grant to Sandia Labs to work around the technology. So we got flanked by a more robust, integrated educational system. I mean, let's be blunt about this thing, is that trying to win these in money is not where you're at. They're taking it to the smart place.
Mr. Chairman, but as Bruce mentions this, I think we also should be very excited about the investments you have made in Oregon Inc. Where we've been a little late at getting to the game, quite frankly, but I think the research centers that you and your colleagues have invested in Oregon Innovation this last session will start turning those dividends and will start bridging that absence of that university slash technology slash laboratory opportunities for these companies. We're starting to see the dividends from that already from Onami. I've just heard, and I think we mentioned it Friday, but there's been seven companies that have spun off of Onami here recently. We'll see the same type of results from the other research centers that you've invested in time. They don't happen overnight, but they will happen, and they become an interesting catalyst or a partnership for us as we recruit these companies, because they want to know in today's economies require that they can't do that research all by themselves, and knowing that they have a university research opportunity partnership is an extremely important commodity to industries that are in Oregon today who want to grow but just can't afford to take on that technology component, would love to do it in a partnership, or companies who want to come to Oregon and, again, don't want to make those hardcore investments that they currently have to make in technology research without partnerships in the university system. So I think we'll clearly start seeing the dividends of those investments more rapidly than we have in the past.
This is my most colorful chart. This is from Stanford. I think the Woods Energy Center also had input. It's just an estimate or some kind of scaling or indication of what people are seeing for the future. And I think one of the reasons I like to include this is it gives you an idea of the scale of the growth in the business. I mean, it's absolutely, there's a lot of astonishing information in there. And there's been a lot of thoughtful attention that went in by the university system. So, again, I was supposed to sequence into this talking about the money. And so the point of this is to talk about the scale. I mean, that's the thing to keep in mind. The scale here is just mind-boggling, how large of scale we're dealing with. It is colorful.
I note, if I may, Mr. Chair, that coal, which is one of the dirtier systems in terms of carbon production, in 2100 is still several times the size it is today under this projection. And you've got the worldwide projections there. Mm-hmm. I hope that with all of these plans you're working on, that everyone in the United States is working on, that the United States itself can do significantly better than this. If this is really what we expect, we're in even deeper trouble than I thought.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you're saying, actually, and I think it's a good point that Representative Barnhart makes, I think the United States as a whole will do much better in increasing the other energy sources, alternative energy sources. I think what drives much of that coal curve and some of the other ones, crude, are other countries that are relying heavily on coal as their byproduct for fueling their economies. And they just have an obsessive appetite that the only thing they can fill that appetite with today is their coal commodities, quite frankly. And I think you've all seen the different projections of concerns as China, and this is particularly around China. China has huge coal commodities that they're using, and they have not seemed to move away too far from the coal as their main source of their energy resource. So until they start picking up more of a sophisticated sense of the importance of a clean globe and trying to accelerate the alternatives out there, I think that we're going to be driven much by them. But I think that's where you see a drop-off on the other side, where they forecast it, is really where
those other countries have realized that they've gone too far and they need us to find the alternatives more practical than the current traditional industries of such coal and things like that.
Well, if I may, please. Your chart shows crude oil dropping off, natural gas dropping off after about 2040, but coal continues to increase through the entire period, the way you've shown this.
Well, Stanford University.
Yeah. I mean, this is a very pessimistic view, in my opinion.
Well, not necessarily. I think if you're referring to your gas emissions, I think everybody says sequestration has got to show up.
I know. It's
well,
yeah.
And certainly the point that Representative Barnhart makes is an extremely important one. I'm by no means an expert, but I understand there may be some opportunities through coal gasification to, in essence, make coal a little cleaner and to also capture some of the carbon that would otherwise be emitted through those technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, I think one of the things to understand, too, is that the price value inside these energy sources is going to change pretty dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, anyway, that's just one view. The point of it is to get some scalability on the renewables so that everybody understands this is a huge, huge thing. Just kind of a definition point is when you're talking about electricity, you're really talking about energy for buildings and oil, it's transportation. And that's just sort of a point that I like to keep in there. We talked about wind. One of the things we didn't talk about is that another area that we're paying a lot of attention to is small scale. And we already know, for instance, there's a professor at Oregon State that's done some fabulous work on small scale building-sized turbines. It's got some press. It's great-looking technology. People like Walmart that are pursuing a large sustainability campaign or testing systems similar to these where they put them on top of their light stanchions. And so we think just as you see solar on rooftops, pretty soon there's potential for building wind turbines and small-scale wind turbines. We think that's a very fast growth area, so that's one of our target areas in wind, is to go after small scale.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where could I find more information on that? Is there a website or?
There is, and we'd be glad to email you all the linkage.
Okay.
Right, hold on, right?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
It's great looking stuff. Vice Chair Lim.
Okay. It seems to me that the wind mills taking a lot of acres, hundreds and thousands,
mm-hmm.
are they able to cultivate the land for farm use, or is this exclusively for the windmill only?
It looks like wheat.
Well, yeah, that it's wheat.
It's wheat, yeah. So it's yeah. combined together?
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Representative Lim, they're able to farm the vast majority, continue farming. There's a small percentage of the property that's taken out for the road, that there's a construction road that leads into all of these and a maintenance road. And then, but the footprint is actually quite small for each one of these wind turbines.
Okay. It's good to know. Thank you.
And, you know, another point I didn't make earlier is the contracts for leases run the gamut, but a typical contract will pay the landowner or rancher about $2,000 per year per turbine.
Ooh.
Is kind of a typical return.
I didn't know that.
I've got a few acres.
Unfortunately, we're not out in the
area. Gosh, you can really stall out on this, I've discovered. anyway, I'll get you an email on that, but we're really paying a lot of attention to small-scale turbines. We think that's the next big frontier. Whereas the large ones are becoming more commodity-like, the small ones really have a lot of movement in it. That, and we mentioned workforce training, we think is a absolutely critical core piece of moving this agenda forward. Okay, where were we? What?
It's our secret.
Something happened here. Well, let's just do it anyway. In wind, innovation is showing up just like everything else. I don't know if anybody recognizes this thing. It's real. They're testing it. They're serious money in this project. They're large scale, I guess you'd call them kites, but they're fairly large scale equipment, and they put them up in the jet stream. And they use kind of the helicopter effect, and they rotor up there and harvest the energy. And so then they put them into parks, and so you have high-altitude flying wind generators. It's quite real. It's quite serious.
I must admit to you, when I first saw this slide, I thought Mr. Laird was pulling my leg. But it just shows you, it just re-emphasizes my statement. The technology, where they're going with this, might be almost Buck Rogers, and you know, when you look at that. But the reality is, this is stuff that there's certified smart people around the world who are trying to figure out another way to not necessarily make a footprint on the ground, but you take advantage of going up into the higher jet streams, where we all know the wind consistency is much more practical than on the ground. The higher you go, the more wind it gets, and so the opportunity to create more generation of power that way is something they're chasing.
Patrick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Where is this project physically actually located, one of them?
I don't know where the test is. I know that Google has money into it, and there's some certified smart people pursuing it. This was a presentation provided, and seriously, we didn't know. Even now, I'm not sure know quite what to make of it. Except that it's an example of the kind of creativity and innovation that's sweeping through there, and I'm certainly not capable of judging if it. I mean, maybe it does make sense.
I accuse Bruce of this could be a byproduct from Area 52. I wasn't too sure.
It is kind of interesting, though. Anyway, well, enough of that.
Vice Chair Lim.
Okay. Let me see. That windmills, you gotta have wind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, in a year, 165 days, how many days it can run?
Well, that's an excellent question, Representative. It's going to depend on the location and the amount of wind that blows in that area. So. Well, I mean, the areas have different, and you can have high-speed gusts but not have the steady, so it takes a particular area to generate the right kind of wind. I think a very, very good location is in the 30% range. I think we might have a better expert in here.
Rob, do you know?
We're going to put them all in Washington, D.C.
I was going to say, one on the mall right out here, possibly. So.
Yeah.
An angle to catch the rising air,
Vice Chair,
follow-up question. What is the breaking point? If you have a 20% UK breaking point, if it's more than that, it makes some profit. What are the breaking point?
Boy, I have to apologize.
I'm sorry, asking hard questions.
Yeah.
And I have another follow-up question, if you don't mind. This is the point I'm trying to driving at.
Mm-hmm.
The turbine is turning, and with the wind, the second one behind might be turning again. So is that a chain reaction coming along? If we don't have enough wind, we might be electrically, manually, or, you know, that... The first ones is turning, and all the following ones might be following up, even though it might be a less wind.
I actually understand Representative Lim's question somewhat, and it's fascinating because we are now looking. We have a project, quite fascinating project, where a smaller scale turbine manufacturer is taking advantage of the effect of capturing a higher percentage yield of the wind that goes by. And they built a turbine through components mostly manufactured in Oregon and Korea, and the first test bed is being done in Korea right now. of this Oregon-based turbine system. So there is new technology going into this all the time to increase efficiency and scalability. Now, there's another subset question in there, which is a technological question about turbulence generated by the blades themselves and the wind behind it. And that is under substantial study right now by MIT and a bunch of those folks.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
I think my question was answered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let me see. Here's our glass tubes. There's edible natural gas costs. There's four component systems in these guys: the tubes, the mirrors, the metal frameworks, and the mechanical drivers. Every single one of these companies in this space has an expansion project going on right now. And so those are all targets.
So again, Mr. Chairman, I want to restate what I stated before. And suppose that just looking at this as an industry and saying that's something we don't want and just summarily dismissing it, while we may, you know, we'll run into some much interesting discussions about the locating of solar farms like this in Oregon, I suspect, because they have some effects on our land use and some of the, you know, people's disposition for these type of alternative. Embedded in there, if you take them as commodities, they become a huge economic opportunity for Oregon manufacturing, where we have some very skilled workforce opportunities and skilled industries that can be part of those four different systems that he designed. So while we may never have a solar farm array like this, we could be working very carefully and cautiously with our industries in Oregon today to try to get them linked up with these type of companies to start making the components. So we may never own a farm, but we could be a very strong participant in the components, which is in this industry is like, as Bruce mentioned, in the wind industry, the biggest bottleneck in their supply side is the components that make the assemblies out of, not so much the locations of these.
Bob, could you give some idea, if I'm a certified solar technician that's been certified through the community college program in Representative Huffman's area, what I might be expecting as a wage, and then perhaps if I were in the manufacturing industry, employed in making these kind of reflective panels, what kind of wage might I anticipate? Any idea?
Not, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I don't know if I have a number I can share with you, but my suspicion would be, and it's only my personal suspicion, that this type of assembly work or equipment that's involved in these solar arrays is very sophisticated mechanical tooling opportunities. It's highly technical, so there's a huge amount of computer stuff that goes along with this. The people who do the servicing of these things have to be pretty certified smart people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is not just somebody who got out of high school and was looking for a job. They have to have some skill sets that enable them to participate and use this equipment properly. So I would arguably tell you, Mr. Chairman, that most of the jobs that are related to this type of industry are higher paying jobs, and to the point where they get into very technically type sophisticated jobs, probably into the $80,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year jobs. So these are higher end jobs. Even though they are mechanical in nature, they are higher end jobs.
And not only do we benefit from a clean technology, mm-hmm. but our communities here throughout the state potentially would be very pleased to be attracting this kind of industry.
Mr. Chairman, while we've had some preliminary discussions with some companies about locating these type of fields in Oregon, I mean, you'd expect that because we have areas in Oregon that are sunshiny parts of the state on a regular basis and pretty barren of any other activity on the land. So there are areas in particular southeast Oregon where we've had those discussions going with these type of companies, which speaks to what was Mr. Laird talked about. This is an industry, then, if you were to locate something like this in the southeast portion of the state, any one of the components, based on our cluster of manufacturing industries that we have all around the state of Oregon, could pick off any component of this. So you could actually have, in theory, certain parts of this type of facilities built in every corner of Oregon, and then assembled and, mm-hmm. And placed into service down in southeast Oregon. So it's just a extremely strong opportunity to have value added to Oregon, all the way from the jobs to the end product for saving energy costs.
Again, this is a global product. The tubes are made right now either in Germany or in Israel. The mirrors are mostly made in Spain and Portugal. Frames are another subject. The motors are another subject. So it's a real interesting global product. They're having trouble producing anything in the Euro and selling it elsewhere. So we think this is a terrific opportunity area. The other thing I might add is that this is not compatible with exclusive farm use zoning, and we're finding that we're looking at a land use exception and whatnot and able to site these out in our rural counties, which is perhaps an issue of note.
A number of us. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read an article that Oregon has the unique silica for solar. Is that the right term, silica?
I understand what's the that's a different technology, but I don't think that's accurate.
So it wouldn't have anything to do with manufacturing.
We'll get that.
Components.
That's up next.
Okay.
Representative Barnhart.
What's the zoning for land where nothing grows and there's no water and
exclusive farm reserve or something, yeah, but these right now we're getting a zoning of it. I think it's industrial required. So almost every place we're looking at, we're at any of these solar farms, we're looking at having to take an exception to the land use plan and go through the exception process and all that.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, we may want to look into land use issues for land which is absolutely and utterly useless for anything else. You know, very carefully defining it so that it
is.
We're not talking about growing trees or wheat or anything, and allowing this sort of thing as a normal use. I'm getting way ahead of myself, obviously, but it's something to consider.
I hope that former Representative Dahlem is listening in on this. He would delight in hearing that.
Well, this is what we have here is something that's evolved relatively, at least come to this part of the world. It's been technology that's used in other parts of the globe. We're starting to say, well, we can use that too. 30 years ago, when we adopted our land use laws, no one ever. This is Buck Rogers stuff. No one ever thought about this 30 years ago, and even where we would have thought about putting in. So what you have now is the technology matching up with our land use plan, and we'll have to make some modifications to if we're going to accommodate these type of alternatives for energy. We'll need to make adjustments within our land use discussions to accomplish that.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, this is one of those situations where the state government needs to be able to respond nimbly to changes in world conditions in order to do things that were, back at the time of Tom McCall, absolutely Buck Rogers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Representative Barnhart, you make a very good point that if we are to be good government, we need to be able to evolve and adapt and be nimble as the situation demands. Representative Huffman.
I'm encouraging my counties to do similar to destination resort mapping. I'm encouraging them to do energy mapping and be proactive. So are you actually looking at this on a statewide level to do, or is there a process of energy mapping for the state going on right now?
Another slide.
Wow,
oh, this is fun. You'll love it. This is great.
I guess I asked the right question.
Talk about this softball. One of the technologies we talked about that we're really have some optimism for is geothermal. And it's one of the ones that Oregon Institute of Technology has mapped out. And the thing about geothermal is this is one of those quiet things that people haven't paid much attention to, I suspect. But it's baseload. And that's something to keep in mind is that the power is 24/7. There is absolutely no carbon involved. And the cost in many of the geothermal wells is running about 4 cents. Now, this is to differentiate from ground pumps for residential commercial buildings. United States is the largest geothermal generating country, about 3,000 megawatts in the United States. And the power source is in the West Coast and then on the East, I think, if I recall correctly. And then OIT estimates that there's over 2,000 megawatts in Oregon resource potential.
Wow.
Now, there's issues surrounding that, of course, but that's an astonishing number. That's okay, there's our map. Oregon Institute of Technology that has a geothermal center. There's two technologies out there in broad sweeping terms. One is just to use the hot water, you know, you don't peak it on up to steam. And then the other is a series of technologies where you actually either capture the heat and then add additional energy, or you do different recovery systems. But the point of it is that it's a resource whose time is coming, and we've got that resource, and look where it's at. So we're pretty excited about this. We have one of our business development officers located in Southern Oregon has taken this assignment on, and he's currently in process of producing a white paper as we ramp up our focus on this energy.
Realizing that you're not from the Department of Energy, we're is that in close proximity to our interstate transmission lines?
This coming down through the Bend Klamath Falls area, absolutely.
Yeah.
It absolutely is. I mean, you think about the natural gas peaker plant down there in Klamath Falls. You're camped out on one of the main transmission corridors. And so you look at those resources, the Newberry Crater and all through there, enormous potential. The other thing about the geothermal is it's pretty inobtrusive when you get down to it. The most you're going to see on a cold day is a little steam.
Mr. Chairman, for those in the committee who've had a chance to have this discussion with Senator Whitsitt, you know that he's a very strong proponent for geothermal because of the Klamath presence, and much of the work and research that's going on at OIT once again speaks to that issue. If we're going to encourage these type of industry opportunities, you've got to have a university presence that has already done an amazing amount of work in this field. So OIT is already well positioned to help us in this work with geothermal. So while Bruce said it's kind of on the lower end of the scale, and I think it's down at the lower end of the scale only because it's not prevalent everywhere in the world or prevalent anywhere that many places in the United States, so you don't see that much of it. But in our state, we're very fortunate to have as many field opportunities that we do have here. So why would we not want to look at it as a reasonable substitute for other types of coal-fired fuels, quite frankly? And then relative to the question that Representative Huffman asked, so this is one kind of mapping of these industries. I can't arguably tell you whether or not we've done mappings in all the other alternative energies, but it really is the thing you need to accomplish if you're really going to start really thinking on the statewide strategic thinking of how do you ramp this up and make it successful in communities.
There are maps on the wave energy that I know of. There's maps on the wind energy that I know of, the geothermal. And solar, there are large macro maps. So I do want to mention that we work in a very collaborative fashion with Oregon Department of Energy, which has staff people assigned to each of these technologies. And you could not ask for a better partner or more leadership. They have just fantastic. They're great. One last one before I leave this. I know we're going to run out of time. I want to mention on this. It's Esencia, which is the Spanish company that builds the mirrors, is the developer of this project. It was financed by Banco Santander and BBVA of Spain and Caixa General de Depósitos of Portugal. And the point of it is the money's coming from all over the world, the technology's coming from all over the world, that this is a global industry. The other thing is that one of these firms just signed a contract for a 563-megawatt facility similar to this in the Mojave Desert, which is going to be about 2,500 acres. and somebody's going to build all the equipment. So, you know, sometimes finding our targets is pretty easy. Here's the dominant technology in photovoltaic. It's the, if you're talking solar, almost everybody thinks of this. Oops. And this is known as monocrystal. And this is probably 85% of all solar sold right now is in this technology area. This has been a core target for us. This is what got us started. And we currently have projects in this technology looking at Bend, Hillsboro, the Portland area in general, Gresham, Salem, Coos Bay, Port of Morrow, and Millersburg, Albany.
What is a project?
Those would be a company that's engaged in the manufacturing of part or some
device.
of this technology.
So, Bruce, would you read those again? I want to make sure that they hear that.
Yeah.
This is they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. Bend, Hillsboro, actually Hillsboro's got two of them, Portland area, Gresham, Salem's got two, Coos Bay, Port of Morrow, Millersburg, Albany. And that's just right now.
And once again, I want to ask the question here, what would one expect the annual income from a job that is producing this kind of technology?
Okay. The one good example, which is a thin film that's looking at Bend and Hillsboro, the company's average compensation, not including benefits, is in the $65,000 to $70,000, not including benefits.
Thank you.
And the total employment at build out is 1,450. Capital investment is $2.2 billion. So you're talking scalability. Now that's a large one, but we did lose a large one that was in the same size last summer. Project something or other. Apricus went to Singapore, and that's another thing is that we're no longer competing with somebody, our next state, we're competing with other countries. This is really a global industry. We have about 20 active accounts in this category area, and it really ranges all over the map. I better keep moving. Here's another technology we're very enthusiastic about, and hope you can see the little circle. That's a little solar hot water. Solar hot water system. Those things are there right now. The growth rate's exponential. They make sense. The payback's very fast, and it's got just an incredibly fast growth rate in producing those. So that's another technology. Can be built almost anywhere. Not overly complex, so we think that one's a great technology to pursue.
And, Mr. Chairman, just to show that you all were ahead of the curve, this last session, through an energy Department of Energy bill, you actually now have allowed the credits to be passed on to the building industry to install these. If you remember, we've always had a very aggressive credit program for these type of alternative type of equipment, but it was only available to the homeowner. Mm-hmm. And you know, the issue is if it wasn't built on the house, the probability of the homeowner is going to step up and do it is much less, as opposed to if the builder was given the incentive to do it, he'll do it because it becomes a marketing feature for them.
Certainly.
So I think you'll see a tremendous increase of houses in the future in Oregon in integrating these type of systems onto their homes.
Great. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I was going to ask a question related to that issue, and that is the question of whether or not we're to the point on this technology where we ought to be requiring these on new construction where there's sunlight. You've just responded with the carrot. I'm wondering about the stick.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Barnhart, you know, I think in any opportunity with the building industry, I can speak because I used to be part of that building industry. If given the opportunity to be a participant in a positive way for Oregon's future, and that it doesn't become a financial inconvenience for the person who's doing the work, I don't see that to be a problem. We went through this about 10 or 15 years ago when we were changing out old un-DEQ certified stoves, some of you were around then, and we gave incentives in order to accomplish that. The building industry said, we understand the importance of having clean air, we understand what it means to the state of Oregon. If you make it so we can work in a partnership with you, we'll be all over it. I think if you join them in that spirit, I think anything's accomplishable.
That's a great answer to my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm a former builder. I'm not a builder today.
We have one company, one manufacturer looking in the Klamath Falls market to manufacture these systems. So, I mean, this really is this is happening all over. It really is. So. Where was I? We've talked a bit about the cellulose ethanol. This is an area that we are going to pay a lot of attention to, but the technology really isn't quite there right now. Geothermal we talked about. Again, we are very optimistic about this, and we're starting to gear up. We have a staff person assigned to it, and so perhaps if you have us back, we'll be able to have an update report on this next time. A great map. We talked about the wave energy. This is an emerging technology. Wind saw a fourfold decrease in their price over about a 12 to 15 year period. If we accelerate that and look at this technology, this will be ready for prime time 4, 5, 6 years out. This is the UK is investing a lot of money in this. This company is located up in Scotland. And has installed units operating now. Again, the manufacturing we think could occur in just about any Oregon coastal community. We think this is a great targeted technology, and we're going to pay a lot of attention to this. We also have the resource similar to geothermal, so this is a target. It's just not quite there yet. And just for the fun of it, we threw in the Hypermini EV program. This is an electric car, Renault Nissan. And notice where the steering wheel is. It's on the wrong side. And this is going to be rolled out in Israel 2011. They have a major program over there to put EVs on the road, to diminish their oil situation. Okay. So what's our 2008 plan? We're expanding from photovoltaic, from the solar focus, to include wind, biofuels, geothermal. We are going to continue to keep the throttle down on solar. I think it's in the long haul, it's the technology that will be a very dominant technology. Wind, absolutely dominant, as we talked about. 2008, we are already engaging. We want to get all of our communities and economic development partners engaged. Our community colleges for the training and more effective coordinated reach out to each of the individual targeted sectors that make sense to our communities. And I think each community could find something in there, whether they want to play on the generation side or whether they're looking at one of those subsystems for manufacturing. We're looking at a web-based strategy. We think Brand Oregon, you know, for so long in my world, we were the green guys. Well, now green is good. Green is the new red, white, and blue. So we're going to take that brand advantage, and we're going to leverage it, and we're going to use a web-based strategy. Collaborate and coordinate with the state agencies. We've talked a bit about that. We've talked about the barriers. That is a key objective of ours, is to break those barriers down and find new collaborative solutions. And then keep marketing. Keep reaching out. Keep trying to learn about the industries and keep after it. So that's my conclusion. And I always like to conclude with Oregon and the best known definition of the word Oregon, Native American word for clean or great water. And it's a heritage that we certainly want to do our best to sustain.
Thank you very, very much, gentlemen. Any final comments or questions from the committee members? A couple of things here just in terms of follow-up. I would very much like to receive a copy of the slide. You said it was your most colorful slide from Stanford University that did their projected world energy supplies. I'd like a copy of that. I would also like
the name of the OSU professor who's doing the small scale wind turbines. Mm-hmm. I have in mind perhaps for the next session our committee going to OSU as a field trip and taking a look at some of the absolute incredible energy development projects that university is doing. Representative Huffman, I was absolutely blown away by the wave technology, both the horizontal and vertical applications of technology there. And if Bruce, in your discussions with the Energy Department, that you're finding land use planning problems, kind of the mapping issue that Representative Barnhart described earlier, would be more than interested in finding out what kind of speed bumps we may have erected that are perhaps inhibiting the development of these technologies at that point.
Could I add to that,
Representative Barnhart?
It is normal for people who live in a particular regulatory environment to think of it as a given, that it's just the world we live in, and that's the way it is. I think it's critically important that that all of us be willing to think creatively about ways in which we can change the regulatory environment to make it more responsive to these changes as we need to do them. Mm-hmm. And that means that people who are working with them on a regular basis need to be ready to say, we have this place where we just routinely jump through these 12 hoops, and maybe there should only be four.
Mm-hmm. And another potential application of adaptive management.
Yeah. But we depend upon the people actually working in the field to tell us, and then we have to come up with creative ways to do the things that the old regulation was supposed to do for us and doesn't anymore.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Chairman, not hearing any other comments, I hope the presentation was enlightening to all of you. I hope it also portrays to you that this agency is on a racehorse, trying to keep up with where the trends in technology are leading us. And I want to make sure that I say this also on the record, that this is not to imply or to suggest that we are abandoning traditional industries in Oregon.
Right.
There is a place for all industries to be advanced through technology, from the food processing industries to the forestry industries. They all are going to benefit from technology advancements. And byproducts, as we talked about, possibly biomass. Biomass will be a huge contributor to forest opportunity or timber activities in the state of Oregon in a way that we've never thought about. So while we might appear to be leaving some of our traditional ways of doing economic activities in Oregon, there are other components that are coming on that will still allow us to participate in a very meaningful way for Oregon in the future, but doing it in a different way. But ending up with probably much more superior products and better results as it pertains to the well-being of Oregon and the environment that we live in.
Thank you very, very much, Bob. A point well taken. I think Oregon has a number of companies that could probably make some of best bearings that are available anywhere in the world. Certainly, existing manufacturers that we have in the state that make aerospace components could certainly be making windmill, utilizing windmill technologies, those sorts of things. So, both existing manufacturers as well as manufacturers that we may be looking to recruit into this, absolutely a point well taken. Gentlemen, I think you can tell from the level of engagement here by our committee, this was, Bruce, as you said, an absolutely thoroughly exciting opportunities here. Thank you both very, very much. Patrick, real quickly here, what are we expecting for tomorrow?
Tomorrow we are going to have a follow-up on some of the information we heard last week regarding workforce. The Employment Department is going to come in and give us 10-year projections on workforce development.
All right. With that, gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone from the audience who'd like 2 minutes? This would be an opportunity if you'd so like.
Not seeing anyone rising to the bait here. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very, very much.